Hi, I'm a helpful Southern California Honda person, and recently we've been doing random acts of helpfulness, like buying gifts for families and bringing a daughter in the Navy home for the holidays. And during the Happy Honda Day sales event, we can help you too with a great deal on an award-winning Honda, like the Accord, a 2017 Car and Driver 10 Best a record 31 times. Click the dealer locator link to find a dealer near you and go to SoCalHondaDealers.com to suggest a random act of helpfulness for someone you know. Car and Driver, January 2017.
Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, happy Friday. Welcome to Somewhere in the Middle with Michelle Berard. I am your host, Michelle Berard, founder and CEO of Urban Book Editor, LLC, and I am so happy to share this hour with you where we examine all those places where spirit meets life and the joys and challenges that may bring. Now, you guys have been listening for a little while, so you know already, but I'm going to say it again. Somewhere in the Middle is intended to be a safe place where we can learn and grow together, and we're going to discuss a variety of topics, ranging from love to politics to money, business, and beyond that, and that is, of course, because the human experience is wide and it is varied. So I know you guys have a lot to share with us, and I don't want you to just listen to us babble at you for an hour. I want you to feel free participating and engaging. So we want to hear from you, right? So as you're listening, get your questions and your comments ready, because in the second half of the show, we'll be taking calls from the audience. Now, you guys already know I like to start out by thanking Ms. Beverly Black and Tribe Family Channel for helping me create this space for us. For those of you who don't know, Tribe Family Champ.
May I please speak?
Yes.
Thank you so much. I accept that. And I just want you to back up from your microphone just a little bit. I'm hearing just a tidbit of static. And
okay.
I think we'll be fine. You're clear now. Perfect. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Great.
Well, and Tribe Family Channel is home to an assortment of shows. They're thought-provoking, they explore life, they explore spirit, business, culture, and that is including The Woman at the Well, hosted by Miss Beverly Black herself. Thank you again to Beverly Black. And I also want to give a shout-out to my last guest, Gary Richardson. He is an entrepreneur and a diversity specialist, and you can connect with Gary at his website, richardsonconsulting.net. You can also get his new book, Beyond Demographics, The Truth About Diversity, on Amazon and at other fine retailers. So if you missed the last show, make sure you listen to the replay. You can get to that replay by visiting Tribe Family Channel online and checking out the show recordings. So you're going to want to look for that November 3rd show in the list there. And you're going to be interested, I think, in that discussion we had about diversity. And also we got into how you go about achieving your personal goals. That was really important. I also like to thank Bruce George for his support. He is the leader, the founder, the visionary of the Genius is Common movement. And that movement encourages all to share our inner genius, share it with the world. We've got to embrace that. And this is super important, especially for the youth, but for all of us really, because it is so important that we recognize that we all have something beautiful and important to contribute. And the world needs our genius. So you can learn more about the Genius is Common movement at www.geniusiscommon.com. Now, guys, I am so pleased to introduce tonight's guest, Dr. Maxine Bryant. Nationally and internationally, she has she's just been described as a dynamic presenter. She has covered topics from customer service to race relations, diversity, and inclusion, all these various topics from the most basic to the much more challenging and delicate to discuss. Maxine Bryant has repeatedly captured the hearts and minds of many audiences. With over 30 years of experience as a professional trainer, she is well-versed in a variety of topics and has presented and or developed workshops, lectures, and keynote addresses for diverse audiences across America, in the Grill, Jamaica, the West Indies, Cairo, Egypt, and Ghana in Africa. Dr. Bryant holds a Bachelor of Science from Ball State University, a Master of Arts from Saginaw Valley State University, and a Doctor of Philosophy and Human Services degree from Walden University. All her degrees have a concentration in criminal justice and corrections. Now, in addition to all of that, as if that's not enough, she's got years of experience leading criminal justice agencies. She is the founder of Bryant Educational Seminars and Training, BEST, an independent training and project development consulting firm. And through BEST, BEST, she has aided in improving the quality of life in communities most affected by crime and violence by offering direct programming to residents and to people with criminal histories. Maxine Bryant also is an author and a poet. She's published two books, I Want My Groove Back, God's Way, and Truth Be Told. So, guys, with all of that wonderful curriculum vita, I want to welcome Dr. Maxine Bryant to Somewhere in the Middle with Michelle Berard. So thank you, Maxine, for coming on the show.
Wow, Michelle. Thank you. Thank you. It is indeed an honor and a privilege to be on Somewhere in the Middle with Michelle. That's awesome.
Well, thank you. You know, we talked earlier in the week, and I'm going to just say again, I'm really excited to have you on the show because you and I have a lot of overlapping interests and experience in areas such as training and coaching and writing, yeah, and poetry in particular. you know, I have a soft spot for poetry and also issues related to the problems associated with incarceration and the way communities of color are impacted by the high incarceration rates in our communities. So that all of that is just fascinating stuff, and the intersection there is just wonderful for me to get into a discussion with you about that. But before we get to all of that, I like to start an interview with two questions. And the reason I like to start with these two questions is because I believe that they lead right into who you are and what you're doing and why. Okay. So here are the questions.
All right.
Dr. Maxine Bryant, who are you and how did you become who you are today?
Wow. Okay. Okay. Who am I? I think the first thing that's important for me in self-defining is that I am Christian. I am a Christian. I am a daughter of our Lord. And that's at my core. I am a person who loves life and all that life has to offer, the good and the bad. I am a survivor. I've been through some really rough times, Michelle, as most of us. Some of us get stuck in those rough times. I have been able to not only survive, but to thrive. So I think in a nutshell, that kind of describes who I am. I am a go-getter, a believer in what is yet to come. So I'm optimistic about life and what it has to offer. And I'm always looking for the good in life and in people. So that kind of describes who I am. And the second part of your question was, what? How did I get here? How did I get to be me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Wow. You know, I think our parents have a big, they play a big role in who we are or who we become, and not just because they shape us, but my mother prayed for me, even when the doctors told her that I would never talk correctly because I had something wrong with my tongue, or when the counselor told her not to waste her money sending me to college because I was not college material. When those negative messages came at my mother, and even when I, you know, as a young girl, began making really bad decisions, my mother never gave up, and she always took me to the Lord in prayer. So she was a prayer, and she's gone to be with the Lord now. But if she were alive now, Michelle, she would be like simply amazed. She'd be like, oh, Lord, you heard my prayer. But so I got here where I am on the prayers of my mother, you know, really.
Wow.
Something I've done on my own in terms of, you know, finishing school and making sure that that was something that I accomplished. But at the core, some of the stuff that has happened to me are, I believe, blessings from God that are the result, the direct result of a mother's prayer.
Wow. Okay. That is, you know, I think that's really interesting because there is some, I've heard people talk about that before. In fact, my ex-husband told me that his mom prayed him back to life. And the
wow.
power of a mother's prayer, that emphasis on the power of a mother's prayer is just fascinating to me.
Yes. Yes. And it is. I am living proof of that, Michelle. I really believe that.
So is that what kind of informs your faith and your optimism?
Now that's a good question. Does that inform? I think to some degree, but I think at some point I had to, you know, my mother's prayer certainly laid a great foundation, but at some point I have to take responsibility for making decisions, for doing what was right for me, for maintaining a level of optimism in the face of fear, degradation, failure even. So I think some of that may be innate, the way we're kind of cut, the way we are designed, and then some of it is just a choice to do the best. So I think it may be a combination of all of that. You know, I'm not any different from many people that you had on your show who have faced adversity but refused to let adversity get the best of me.
Right. So you mentioned that you're a survivor.
Yes.
And that just begs the question of what kinds of things have you survived?
Wow. So let me start as a child. I can remember being like three or four years old, because I was young enough to stand on my mother's couch and not get a beating, right? So I remember standing on my mother's couch, and there was a man, a deacon at our church, nevertheless, who would come over to visit my parents, and they trusted this man. So they may be in another room, and he was watching TV, and they wouldn't be gone long. It's not like they were, like, gone for an hour or so, but they were doing things. They were, you know, my mom may have been cooking, and maybe dad was doing something else, right? But while they were out of the room, he was physically molesting me with his fingers, you know, because my mother always made me wear dresses. And I remember thinking, that right is something wrong about that. And it wasn't until, obviously, years later that I realized I was being molested. Right?
Wow.
And so that changes everything about a little girl. It takes away the innocence. But I survived that. I did not let that childhood molestation hold me bondage. So then fast forward, because I think it set in motion a number of things. So fast forward to college years, and I was raped while I was in college.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, and certainly I do not take responsibility for all of that, but for that piece. But making wrong choices about being in places, right, and contributed, no doubt, to some of the things that may have happened. Then I began looking for love in all the wrong places, and I got married and divorced and married and divorced and married and divorced. So I'm a survivor of those kinds of bad choices, having been married 3 times and divorced 3 times. And my second husband was physically and emotionally abusive. I survived that, right? I survived bankruptcy in my life, being on public assistance and the ridicule that I received from my case manager, my case worker, rather, who, you know, got joy, I believe, out of putting me down and making me feel bad, right? I survived having a home during the foreclosure, because there was a time, even though I had managed my money well, was living well off of my business, in 2009 and to 2010, if you will remember, the economy out of, you know, and I often say I couldn't even pay people to hire me to the development that my business did. And that was after a good run, you know, about 11-year run of making, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and being, you know, asked to travel across the country and across the world, deliver speeches and writing books and all of that. And then I found myself on public assistance because I lived off of my savings for about a year. And then after that, I just had no more money, right? The final thing I think that I can say I have survived is the death of my daughter. And that was the one that knocked me off my feet. My daughter was 31, had become addicted to a drug called Sherm, and that's PCP laced in either a cigarette or a marijuana joint.
Oh, wow.
Black out when she would get high. She lived in Vegas. She would black out. When I realized she was addicted, I tried to get her help, tried to, you know, intervene to the best of my ability. I lived in Indianapolis at the time, and as I said, she was in Vegas. And we talked on the day after Thanksgiving in 2011 and had a wonderful conversation. I was had just finished the classwork, working on my PhD, getting ready to go into the dissertation phase. And she was telling me how proud she was of me. And I was telling her how proud I was of her. And we exchanged mutual, you know, hey, I love you, Mom. I love you, baby girl, you know, all of that. And that was my last conversation with her.
Oh, wow.
Excuse me. I received a call that was Friday night after Thanksgiving of 2011, and Saturday afternoon I received a call that she had drowned, and she had been getting high on turn by the backyard pool to the house where she lived in, and had blacked out and fell into the pool and drowned. And I survived. I survived. I am surviving. I'm not going to say I have survived, because that's continual. If you notice, we're now in November. The day she died was November 26th. So every year this time, this time of the year, I am reminded of the significant loss. But yes, I am surviving. So when I tell you that I have survived a lot, I think now you are a believer.
Oh, yes, I can see that, definitely, definitely. Wow. Well, as a mother, I'm going to start out by offering my condolences, because I know that is a pain that never truly goes away. I can't even imagine it.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right, Michelle. It never goes away. It is. I miss my daughter daily, and so it's that dull pain that is always there, that I'm learning to live with.
And that's really what it is, isn't it? It's learning to live with and through the various pains that we experience in life.
It is. And not letting them pull you down to a place where you're stuck. Because, you know, my story is not all of that dissimilar from other stories. They may not have gone through as much as I've gone through, but, you know, I know people who've been through marriages and divorces. I know other women, many women, who've been molested as children. I know people, women, who've lost their children, whose children died before they did, which is just, you know, like totally whacked anyway. But they got stuck. I know people who've gone through those types of things, and they get stuck in a place of depression, in a place of maybe anxiety, a place of not being able to move forward, just stuck. And I couldn't get stuck, Michelle. I could not. Something in me would not let me stay in those places. I may visit. You know, there were times certainly I visited depression. There were times certainly I visited negative thinking and all of that, but I knew I couldn't live there. I could not make my habitation in those places.
So let me ask you then, I've been married and divorced twice, so I have visited those places a couple of times myself. But for me, every time I was able to just focus on my kids, that was what I did. I focused on my kids. And I think that's what kept me going. They needed me more than I needed to kind of sit and wallow in that place, right? What was it for you? What was it that kept you moving forward and helped to pull you out of that?
That's a good question. It certainly I can say from marriage number one, well, maybe from marriage, for all three of the marriages, my children served as that kind of anchor for me. So it kept me grounded and kept me looking in the future. For the other things that I have gone through, I would say definitely my faith and knowing that my right now is not my always. That's my mantra. You know, I'm in the valley now. I'm going through now. Times are rough now. Money is tight now. my heart is broken now. All of those things, I'm in physical pain now. But my now is never my always. And so as I continue to move forward, my right now becomes my past. And I continue to move forward into my future. So
I
my
like
realization
that.
Is what helped me. My right now is not my always.
Okay, I'm going to just steal that quote from you. I'll attribute you, but I'm going to steal that from you just so you know. I'm a big proponent of stealing what's good and what works, right? But I will give you credit, just so you know. I give credit where credit is due, but I'm going to say that over and over again.
Really, you know, that positive self-talk is fine. And particularly when I was going through the when I was going through the financial stress. So I can remember at one point I lived in Indianapolis and I wanted to go across town. And all I had was $10. Now, do I put that $10 in the gas tank and go across town? Or do I stay my little at home and do something else with that money, like buy hot dogs or something for my kids and I eat? I wanted to go to this event so bad, but I couldn't. It would not have been a wise decision to get in my car and use that kind of gas, right? So I remember thinking, Lord, if I can ever just get my hands on money, if I make money, I just want the opportunity to be a blessing to other people. I remember praying, I want to be blessed to be a blessing, right? But it could have been so easy for me just to give up then, you know, and like I couldn't see my way out. I really could not see. I couldn't, you know, where's the blessing? Where's the miracle going to come from, right? So I held on to that mantra. You know, no matter how long I'm in this dark place, this lonely place, this dreadful place, this place, I will not reside in this place very long. It's not going to be always. And I share that when I knew that things were going to look up for me. Can I tell that story?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay. I remember I was down to my last $20. And this time, both of my parents had been deceased. I have a sibling that I could call on. They had loaned me money or whatever. I had been robbing Peter to pay Paul. I had borrowed from friends to the extent that I felt comfortable borrowing. And I had no money in the bank. I had $20, period. $20 to my name. And I had someone had called me and wanted me to do a training, a workshop. And I needed to get a tool, a prop, rather, for that particular training. I went to, like, Hobby Lobby or something like that, Michael's, I think it was. And I bought the item, I don't think they had the item that I wanted. The $20 had fallen in the store. I cried. I remember having a meltdown in my kitchen. And I'm like, God, you know, I needed the money, you know, from this training. I just stopped. I don't have $20 anymore. I mean, I felt like, you know, like someone had just taken a dagger and just really just shot at me, just stabbed me. And I remember being led to get up off my knees and go upstairs and use my phone to call the store. The store was getting ready to close. And I called the store, and the guy said, yeah, like somebody's going to turn in $20. I'll take your name and number, but, you know, you might as well kind of forget that. Now, about an hour later, they called me, and someone had turned in the $20 bill.
Wow.
And I knew then, I said, okay, God, you've got me. You have got me. And less than 2 months later, I received information that there was a community in Indianapolis that had money that had money to spend, and they needed to hire a person to engage in offender reentry work. And I interviewed for it, and this was like maybe in October. They needed to spend $40,000 between October and December. So they were going to give that $40,000 to the person who they hired to do this work. Still, I got that money. I got the contract, and it was up and going. I was like, okay, God, I hear you. I hear you.
That
so
is it.
It was, yeah, it was good. It was. That was when I knew that, okay, I got to stop it. And every time, any time after that, that I got depressed or in a dark place, I would remember. So.
Well, you know, that's what we call evidence, right?
So
that's your evidence. So let me ask you then, how would you describe faith? What do you, how would you define faith, and how does it act in your life actively?
Yeah. So I once heard a pastor describe faith coming out of, I want to say it's Hebrews, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And he said, faith is acting like a thing is so, even when it is not so, so that it can become so, right?
And
I thought that was kind of catchy, that was kind of cute, but I needed for it to be practical for me. And so what I began to do was internalize and say, faith is me believing that God is able to do the miraculous without my help. It's me believing that the very thing that I think is impossible is going to happen. So can I tell you another story? This is more recent.
Yes. Yes.
So everyone should know the college professors make no money. We don't make any money. We get the title. We get summers off. We get spring break, Christmas break, Thanksgiving break, all of that. But we don't make no money. So, when I came to Savannah and I realized I took like a $35,000 cut in pay when I moved here and started teaching. I'm like, oh, Lord Jesus, I can do this. Whoa. So I prayed and I'm like, God, I need to make a little bit more money. So he blessed me with a contract for about a year and a half when my salary like tripled. And I thought, okay, this is cool, but it was really a difficult contract for me to do, and I decided to bow out of it, and it was difficult for a number of reasons outside of myself. But that ended in June of this year, yeah, June of 2017. And by now, I've been in the university system long enough to have gotten some merit raises. And I decided, okay, God, I'm going to make do with what you give me. I'm not, you know, I'm going to manage what you have given me. We're good. I'm going along my own merry way, wanting, you know, would love to make more money, but not, I'm good. Michelle, when I tell you a blessing, like, fell out of the sky, I see the phone call, and I'm a lecturer at the university, so I'm not on tenure track, so it means I'm not getting ready to get tenure. I'm a junior faculty. I've only been there for 4 years. Of junior faculty, I get a call from the provost, the interim provost, because our university is being consolidated. And he says, you know, Maxine, we've been looking around. We need to fill a position in the interim, director of equity, diversity, and inclusion. And we want you to do that. I'm like,
oh,
me.
Wow.
So I meet with, I'm like, okay, Dad, what you doing? So I meet with the president of the current university and the incoming president that will begin in January. And based on what they're telling me, it's even better than that. Beginning in January, the position transitions to Associate Provost of Diversity and Faculty Development. So
I'm like
real big in higher ed and academia. That's astonishing, right? I'm junior faculty. I'm new junior faculty. I'm not on tenure track. So I skipped all of the layers that you're supposed to follow for advancement in higher ed. I skipped assistant professor, associate professor, chair, director, dean. I skipped all of those layers. And I am now the associate provost, right? I'm like,
wow.
How do you do that?
Wow.
So I got, you know, just like I have testimonies of overcoming and surviving, I have testimonies of thriving in the hands
right.
of God, right?
Right. So that's key, isn't it, to remembering that you don't just have stories of woe. You also have
right.
your stories of triumph to fall back on.
Absolutely. Yes.
So now I want to ask, what exactly does this position entail? So it's associate provost, you're going to be doing what? Is it diversity type work on the campus or?
Exactly. So that role entails developing opportunities, training and development for faculty and staff around diversity and inclusion issues. And as you noticed in my bio, I have that kind of experience behind me in the private sector, right? It also entails working with admissions to ensure that we're recruiting diverse populations or people from underserved populations into the university, and then going beyond that and retaining those students who come from those marginalized populations, and with faculty, making sure that we recruit and retain faculty, that we are engaging in searches for faculty that reach a larger demographic, and that we're being strategic about going after faculty who come from underrepresented populations. Now, once we get people on the campus, because the campus is a PWI, it's a predominantly white institution.
Okay.
People from diverse populations get there, then it is my job to make sure programs and things are in place to keep people there. For example, we have a program for men, for the young men on campus, and my mind just went blank in terms of what that's called. One of them is called MOVE. The other is for our young men, we have that program that provides mentorship and social outlets and support for our young black men on campus. We also have a Hispanic group for the Hispanic girls called HALA. We also have for African-American girls a program that's called Student African-American Sisterhood that is part of a national organization that actually my stepdaughter, Khalila Shabazz, started that. She's the founder of that. So we have that on our campus to support African-American females in being successful. And all of those programs have increased our graduation rates among black and brown students tremendously. Now we're looking at an 80 percentile rate of graduation
wow.
as a direct result of participation in those kinds of programs. So I want to make sure that we maintain those programs. I want to make sure that that faculty's needs are met. And it became really, really clear about a month ago that we need to address the what faculty don't know or their level of discomfort. We had a situation on our campus where someone had written some derogatory comments about black people, and it said they wrote it in a men's restroom, I think it was a ladies' restroom in a science building, and it said, "Today is the day. All niggers will pay. He's coming, bang, bang." With the climate of our country right now, that's
right.
everybody on high alert, right? I was not in this position at that time. But shortly thereafter, like within 2 weeks, is when they asked me to step up and fill this void. But as I talked to various professors around the campus, particularly our white professors, I was hearing people say that they wanted to be able to support students. They didn't know how to have the conversation in the classroom, and so they didn't, because a lot of white people don't feel comfortable talking about race, right?
Right.
Well, part of my job is to help them to learn how to do that and develop a level of comfortability with having those kinds of conversations.
Gotcha. That's actually so desperately needed right now. I remember walking onto, I attended Agnes Scott College in Atlanta, in the Atlanta metro area, and I remember walking onto campus. I transferred in the middle of a bit of a racial ruckus when I transferred into campus, and I had no idea what was going on when I transferred in. And the tension on the campus was palpable.
Wow.
And the inability to communicate was evident. And fortunately, they put a lot of resources, a lot of, you know, it's a very small school, and so they were able to put a lot of resources to getting everybody talking. But it was only through a concerted effort, a really focused effort, that we saw any, what I would call anything close to healing during the time that I was there. But the evidence of the success that they had to me was when I went back for my 25th year reunion. Oh my gosh, I can't believe I said that out loud. I went for my 25th year reunion. I'm still like, wait, I feel like I'm still there. What? But I went, and there were so many. Oh, yeah. You see, I don't think I'm going to be able to say that out loud. I just know that. When the time comes, I'm like, no, I don't think I'm going to say that. But I was so overjoyed to see how many more students of color there were on campus. I mean, it was like, wait, this is crazy. Like, y'all look like y'all almost the majority now, and I'm freaking out.
Wow, okay.
You know, but they made a commitment. They really made a commitment to recruitment. And if you look at, they actually broadcast the graduation over the internet, because Oprah was there this year. Yes, and so I was like, yes, I got to see Oprah. I can't be there, but I'm going to see Oprah. I kid you not. It was amazing, and the class was so diverse. The class, it was amazing to see all these different women just going out into the world, you know, to make things better for everybody, and it just was heartwarming. So I know that by putting that kind of effort forward, campuses really can make a difference. They can make a huge difference in their community locally, but also the wider community.
It has to be intentional. It has to be deliberate, right? It has to be strategic. And so even for our university, I have a vision of us being a resource center, a diversity hub, a clearinghouse of information, if you will, so that when people in the community want information, they want speakers, they want resources around diversity and inclusion, we can be that place. So that's my long-term vision.
That's beautiful. Well, and that leads right into, you know, my other questions for you about working with the community at large. Because so when I moved to Atlanta some years ago, I seriously considered going to Savannah, because I'm from New Orleans, and Savannah reminds me of New Orleans, except it's much cleaner. It's much cleaner. You don't have that early morning smell of urine as you walk down the street. It's just a little bit different. So,
I know, right?
But I love Savannah. Absolutely beautiful, amazing town. I love it. I love it. I love it. We were there every other weekend for months as I was trying to make this decision. And ultimately, wow, I decided to stay in Atlanta because of what I perceived as not very good public schools. And
okay. You're right.
And well, and that gets to the other issue that you and one of the issues that you and I have an overlapping interest in, and that is the incarceration rates and the way mm-hmm. incarceration affects our communities. And obviously, there's that school to prison pipeline that we wonder, you know, that we all talk
right.
about, and so forth. So how do you think that the university can serve as a bridge, or do you think that the university can serve as a bridge to help raise the community up, the larger community of Savannah? Because there are some parts that are beautiful and that are wealthy, and there was a lot of gentrification going on when I was looking around there some years before. But there are a lot of areas that are really tricky, right? So how can the university act, or and what you're trying to do, how can that act in the community at large?
Okay. So I'm going to answer that question by starting off with kind of pigtails on what you said earlier about the poor schools, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about the fact that Georgia has among the lowest graduation rates in the country, and we
mm-hmm.
have among the highest incarceration rates in the country,
mm-hmm.
then you begin to see that there's a definite connection between education and incarceration. So when our education is low, our incarceration rates are going to be high. So there's a definite link there. Let me say one other thing before I go into actually answering your question. We often look, you talked about the school to prison pipeline. When you look at the majority of the schools in urban communities and black communities, they are in neighborhoods that suffer economically. Well, schools rely on property taxes for funding. So if you have a majority black school in an urban neighborhood where the property value is low, then they don't receive the same amount of dollars per capita as your school in a suburban white neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times people don't realize that, but when we wonder why there's such a strong connection between that school-to-prison pipeline, a lot of it begins with the poor quality of education that we receive in our community schools anyway. So I just
mm-hmm.
wanted to put that out there.
Right.
And universities then have a vested interest in changing that around, because if we can graduate more people from elementary school and from high school, then we then create a pool that can attend our colleges, right? So there can be a selfish interest on the part of universities. So to answer your question, I have already begun doing some of that at Armstrong. And I think this position allows me to do it even on a greater scale. And I think other universities have seen the value in connecting with their communities also. One of the things I have at the Armstrong University every year I'll be doing it for my fourth year next year. It's called When is the Debt Paid Conference? And it is for people with criminal history. They give me money to have it on campus. It is free for people who are being released from prison. And I bring in a nationally known speaker every year who's been there and done that. I've never been incarcerated. So now that I can say I haven't done. I don't have that
okay.
But I do have the passion for working with that group of people. And to have people come onto the campus and be exposed to what we have to offer opens a door, perhaps, for Armstrong to be a college of choice for people to consider. So that's one way. The other thing is that it forms a bridge between the campus community and the Savannah community, because for a long time, there was a lot of tension between the two entities, the school campus as well as Savannah. And so I think the work that I've done in the community around offender reentry and connecting that to Armstrong helps to bridge that bridge, so to speak. Now, in this role, what I want to do is to, and I'm going to use the word grow up, but it's not, I don't mean that in a negative way, but I want to develop, maybe that's a better term, I want to develop people on campus who can be champions for diversity. That's what I'm calling them. I also want to develop both and a physical resource. I want the Savannah community to view us as a source of information, a source of talent that can help address diversity issues. But by the same token, the university has an opportunity to value the richness of culture that exists right here and utilize that culture as we stabilize our being, our entity, as we continue to emerging with Georgia Southern, which has the propensity to make us like even whiter, if you will, but to take advantage of the richness from the Savannah community. And so now we have a mutually beneficial relationship going on, if you can. So that's what I'm trying to do. But I do think that universities need to realize they're not in a vacuum and they cannot exist without the people in that community, the surrounding community, supporting them. And then so it becomes reciprocal. The university contributes to the community, both in tangible ways as well as in non-tangible, you know, resource information, and that the community has an opportunity now to partner and feed into by way of people, students, all of that to the university. So those are some of the ways in which I believe universities can help to eradicate or at least reduce that whole prison through the prison pipeline and sow some positiveness into the communities that they are a part of. And for me, a big part of that is going to address offender reentry.
Well, and actually, that's something I'm curious about in terms of programs that you've run, because I've recently heard about a program that I think started in San Quentin where they are teaching incarcerated folks how to code, you know, do computer programming. And their claim to fame at this stage, as I recall, was a zero recidivism rate, because people are coming out and getting well-paying jobs. They're supposed to be expanding that program to right up the street from, well, I'm saying up the street, right here in Chino, there's a women's prison, I understand, and they're supposed to be expanding that program there. And so I'm wondering what kinds of programs, if any, are going on in the state of Georgia, because Georgia does love incarcerating people, but does Georgia have any real programs in the prisons that you know of to help people to get better paying jobs when they come out, or even just, you know, what kind of reentry programs do they have and what do those entail?
So Georgia has a lot of reentry programs. Now there is one, and I'm not sure that it's off. I'm thinking it's offered by one of the universities. We don't offer it at the university we're in, but it's called Inside Out, where you, the university provides classes to inmates inside of a prison, and those same inmates have an opportunity to come to the campus, if I'm not mistaken. I think that there are some pilot programs along those lines. I would love to see our university and more universities get involved in those specific types of programs for people who are incarcerated. Now, in terms of reentry programs, there are a lot of both state and private reentry programs that help people once they get out. I've been trying to replicate a program that actually started in Ohio called Citizen Circle. I call mine Neighborhood Networks, and I replicated it in Indiana, but not here. But it's like going into the prison with a person, begin meeting with a person 6 months prior to getting out, and then working with them while they're in to develop a plan, at the same time training individuals who are outside, who live in the community, who volunteer to form a type of support group. Many people who come out of prison only have their peers to hang out with, the same folks that they were hanging out with before they came in. Well, if we surround them with a new network, hence the name Neighborhood Network, if we surround them with a new network of connections, then we can begin to shift their paradigm and point them in different directions with support that they need to be successful. So that's like something that I've been wanting to get started forever and just have not been able to get it off the ground here in Savannah yet. But that's just some of that. Inside Out is a program that's designed specifically for universities and prisons to connect.
Okay. Okay, that's awesome. Well, I know that we had a couple of callers on the line. I think they may have had to drop off. I know there are some folks listening online. If anybody has any questions, we can go ahead and open up the lines. I think we have area code 617. Okay, I think they got disconnected.
Well, I would like to come in. Ladies, I want to commend you on this episode of Somewhere in the Middle with Michelle Berard. Dr. Maxine Bryant, you two have been dropping gems, and I've taken a lot away from this, so much so that I believe I have a lot of people that would benefit from what you two have said today. Michelle spoke of the, you know, recidivism rate going down because of the coding, and I appreciate that input. And all of the diversity speak that you ladies are bringing forward is exactly what the landscape of our global nation, our global you know, landscape needs right now. So I want to commend you, and I just wanted to make that statement because it's very important and very profound. So thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that. And actually, I wanted to ask you, because we're coming up at the top of the hour, and I try to be very mindful of people's time, so I don't like to go over too much. But I did want to ask, because I know this is a little bit left field of what we were talking about, but do you have anything of your writing or poetry that you'd like to share with us before we wrap up the session?
You know what I do, particularly for women who find themselves like in the middle, sometimes find ourselves in the middle of loneliness or in the middle of a bad relationship or in the middle of just crying because we're just tired of being tired, right? So in my book, The Truth Be Told, I have a poem called I Have Excelled, an autobiography. So I just like to read a snippet from that. I won't read the whole thing. Okay?
Okay, that's wonderful.
Tony.
Thank you.
Okay. Tony will never breathe again. Terry is waiting to excel. I am neither. But you see, I concluded years ago that breathing without a man is better than holding my breath waiting for one. I have excelled. Oh, I too held my breath for a long time, too long, in fact. I looked, I waited, I searched for my African king to save me from life's ugly demons. I prayed, I cried, and king stood waiting on the wings of love to rescue me. I stopped breathing, anxiously awaiting his appearance. I entered into disappointing relationship after disappointing relationship. Sometimes my African king disappointed me. Often, I disappointed myself. That's a snippet. That's it.
That's awesome. That is awesome. You know that waiting to exhale can kill you.
I know, right?
You don't want to hold your breath too long because that can definitely.
Hold it too long. It can kill you. Yeah, absolutely.
So what inspired you to write that particular poem?
Failed relationship. You know what, Michelle, for a long time I really did do that. I was like holding my breath for Mr. Right to come along, and then the Mr. who I thought was right come along, and I'm good, I'm breathing again, I'm good. And then I find out, ooh, wait a minute, baby. No, you are not it. And I realized I need to stop doing that. That was self-destructive, right? Holding my breath, waiting for Mr. Right. And so there's a part in the poem where I say that somewhere in my search I found myself. And I looked at the woman in the mirror, and I realized that I was strong and beautiful and smart and lovable and talented, and that I could be free of the waiting. And I began putting those words to a poem. And that's how the poem came about. And so it ends up on a good note. It's like, okay, I've learned the importance of grieving for myself without assistance. I have it there.
That's wonderful. That is wonderful. So we are at the top of the hour, so I just want to ask you, what do you have going on that you want our listeners to know about?
Let's see. Every other Monday, I have the Dr. Maxine Bryant Show. So,
yay!
They can tune in at the same address that you're on. Beverly Block is the bomb. So I'm on the same platform. And the next Dr. Maxine Bryant Show is going to be November the 27th. So I'm on 2 Mondays out of the month, every other Monday. November the 27th at 5 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on the Thrive Family Channel. So I'm excited to be a partner with you and others who Beverly Black has blessed with the platform to be able to speak to.
Awesome, awesome. And so everybody, make sure that you follow Maxine Bryant. You can find Dr. Maxine on Facebook, right?
Right.
What's your Facebook handle?
Maxine Bryant. I kept it real simple.
Okay, Maxine Bryant.
Yep, on Twitter is Maxie B Tweets.
Maxie B Tweets on Twitter. So make sure you guys follow her. And Dr. Maxine, remind everybody where they can find your books.
Oh, awesome, yes. The website is mygrooveback.com, mygroove, G-R-O-O-V-E, back.com, all one word. And on that website, you can buy both the books, one or either one. I Want My Groove Back God's Way, and the book of poetry called The Truth Be Told. So go to the
awesome
website.
Awesome. And I think that you are debuting Incarcerated Lives Matter. Is that correct? Incarcerated Lives Matter 2?
Yes. Incarcerated Lives Matter 2. And I will be hosting that. And I believe the very first segment of that is going to take place on Saturday, November the 25th. Saturday, November the 25th. And I have to look to see what time that is on. Perhaps our producer can help me out there.
Let's see.
I'm looking.
5 p.m. Pacific.
Okay, thank you. I was looking to 5 p.m. Pacific time. Incarcerated Lives Matter, please.
Awesome.
Sign on. Yeah.
And that's November 25th.
Right.
Very good. Very good. Very good. Well, Maxine, thank you so much for joining me here on Somewhere in the Middle with Michelle Broad. It has been such a great conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time. That's our show this week, guys. You can reach out to me online at urbanbookeditor.com or on Facebook and Instagram as Urban Book Editor. Make sure you send me a note. I'd love to hear from you. Feel free to send in some topics you'd like us to cover on the show. And again, big shout out to Beverly Black, Tribe Family Channel, and all the members of the Tribe Family Channel, including Dr. Maxine Bryant. And it is a pleasure and an honor to be part of it. You guys, be good. Stay mindful, remain prayerful, and I will see you again on Tribe Family Channel on Friday, December 1st, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Mountain, 5 p.m. Pacific, and can you believe it's almost the end of the year? I can't even believe it. Peace and blessings, y'all. Peace and blessings.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Right now, save 50 to 70% off at Banana Republic factory stores and online. And 60% off absolutely everything at Gap factory stores. Save even more with 40% off clearance at Gap factory stores. And at Banana Republic factory, sweaters start at $19.99 and scarves start at $9.99. Hurry! Search our store locator for your nearest Gap factory and Banana Republic factory store or shop us online. Right now, save 50 to 70% off at Banana Republic factory stores and online. And 60% off absolutely everything at Gap factory stores. Save even more with 40% off clearance at Gap factory stores. And at Banana Republic factory, sweaters start at $19.99 and scarves start at $9.99. Hurry! Search our store locator for your nearest Gap factory and Banana Republic factory store or shop us online.